come here from things that weigh on our hearts, but they are smaller things than these. And so we need to be diligent. We need to be responsible and filled with the compassion and love for the church that you love unspeakably. Lord, make us to pray with the apostle that we as a congregation of the saints would understand the breadth and the height and the depth that you love the church with. So, Father, today, with that resonating on our heart about your affection and your passion, make us to be responsible and good stewards of this local blessing that we have called church. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. This morning, we'll start with, I'll just pull these two pages off here. Church polity. We're gonna write a lot today. We're going to scribble a lot. And so as we walk our way through, we're going to talk in kind of summary statements about church polity. Church polity is the organization and structure of church life, the organization and structure of church life. And so we'll start talking about that polity. Now, could anyone help us review the four types of church polity, of church governance structure that are present in evangelical churches? I had to stretch out the word evangelical. I'm not sure that they're all four used in evangelical churches. Can you help us? The four types of church governance that are present in evangelical church life? Okay, there's a Presbyterian model. This really would be summarized by a board of men that are the elders who function completely independent from, they have internal accountability, but not external accountability. So the board itself would not be accountable to anyone. They would pass down conclusions to churches. Okay? Another? My Presbyterian brothers would be very upset that I had defined it that way, but we'll run with that. Yeah, some of them. Okay, now Episcopal. This is where I really stretch to say evangelical, because the Episcopal model would not fall in the category of evangelical. But you have an episkopos, you have a ruler who really could become a dictator, who just says this is what all the churches under me are going to do. Okay, and then the other two, which one? Congregational eldership. I would qualify that there's very seldom just congregational, but not never. So in other words, a church here in town, that anyone know, that is just congregational? A church here in town that is just congregational. In other words, they until recently would not affirm any elders, just the congregation. Bible Truth Chapel, yeah. Before Eric Shelley came to Bible Truth Chapel, they were exclusively a brethren or congregational church, not acknowledging any sort of eldership in their congregation. So it's present, but it's not one of the four that we're defining. So congregational eldership is one of them. That's one we're discussing. And then congregation or elder rule. So congregational eldership versus elder rule. And elder rule is in a lot of ways like Presbyterian, where the elders are not functioning along with congregation, but they're functioning instead of congregation. So there's really not any congregational function. So these four types of church polity. We've been setting our time and our attention on congregational leadership. Congregational eldership, which is elder leadership rather than elder rule. It's elder leadership. So we're still acknowledging the essential presence of congregationalism. And the quote we've used to really stress that it's congregational eldership is that quote by Jonathan Lehman. Because the work of the Spirit has begun in us, we are congregational. Because the work of the Spirit is not yet complete in us, we have eldership. Okay? Because we're not yet what we should be, we have people that we entrust our spiritual discipleship to formally as a congregant. But because we are already priests unto God, we are congregational. All right. Now, when we talk about church polity, it really boils down to two things. Chaos and order. Chaos and order. Now, we're going to spend our morning talking about this one, but let's distinguish what this is, chaos. How does chaos happen? Well, I would contend that there are two extremes, and everything in between can lead to chaos. There are two extremes. One of them is dictatorship. Dictatorship. This would be an extreme where there is really an unchecked, unaccountable, single figurehead who calls shots. That would be one extreme that leads to all forms of chaos. The other extreme of that, so you have this glaring distinction of singular headship. Then you have this other extreme, which is an ambiguous identification of leadership. You have dictatorship, which is clearly illuminated one figurehead who is unaccountable, at least in practice. Theoretically, there's accountability somewhere, but in practice, there's not. And then you have this ambiguous, unidentified leadership. Now, you know the history of this particular ecclesia, this particular church, better than I do. And so I can only venture guesses at if either one of those could have at some point in our history applied to us at least an opening of the way toward dictatorship or an unidentified leadership. The alternative to this chaos is order. Now, do we imagine that God would will order for us? Do we imagine that God has willed order? Yes, we do. He is a good God. He is a father. He is nurturing. He is caring. God's will in order. Let me say a word about, I'm going to say a hard word about unidentified. I think sometimes, and I don't know that this is the case here, but having been in church my entire life, variety of church, variety of flavors of church, I would make this statement. To think of deacons as elected leaders because they have some members among them who are qualified for elder leadership is undistinguishable leadership. So to think of deacons as leaders because they have some members among them who are qualified for elder leadership is undistinguishable leadership. And this is the part where I think applies most to us. I believe that it's unfair to men who are particularly gifted to serve and not lead. I think to treat deacons like elders is unfair to men who would will to serve but not lead. So if I were to take yeah, you don't fit the illustration. Eric Baker. He doesn't go to church here. If I were to pick Eric Baker, I could pick some. Let's do this. I'm going to pick Matt Ross. Now, I have witnessed in these 6 months, I have witnessed Matt do things that are behind the scenes service responsibilities. I have seen him plan our 4th of July picnic and put together a petting zoo. I have seen him meet with Mike to talk about the things that we need updated for technology in the building. I've seen Matt carry these things out. I have also witnessed some of the men who are deacons who are completely competent for elder leadership. But for us as a congregation to look at deacons and say, okay, we're thinking elder leadership when we say the word deacon, is to really make Matt unqualified to be a deacon. Does that make sense? I'm afraid that if we're not careful to distinguish between elder leadership and deacon service, and not that deacons don't lead in things, deacons have to lead in things, but when we use the term generally for their function, it's service. And I'm concerned that we somehow elevate the position and eliminate some of those people most qualified for it. And Matt is one example. I'm sure you could come up with dozens of people who exhibit. I think Bob fits that category. I think Bob has a service heart. I think he wants to help other people, but doesn't necessarily aspire towards some sort of elder leadership. I just don't think that that's what we're seeing in and Bob's character, but I think you know him better than I do. So I think we have to be careful about unidentified, some sort of pseudo-deacon eldership, because I think then we take people who are amazingly gifted and we exclude them from the position of deacon, which is essential in church life. So what has our God of order gifted us for? What has our God of order done? 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 14, if you'd like to turn there. Just because I don't think we should go through Sunday school and not have flipped the pages. 1 Timothy 3:14. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 14 says, I hope to come to you soon, but I am writing these things to you so that if I delay, you may know how you ought to behave. The apostle has written a pastoral epistle to his young disciple, who he calls his son in the faith, a manual on how to behave in church. It's a beautiful manual. It says all sorts of things about men lifting holy hands when they pray, about congregations taking care of widows who are truly widows, about distinct qualifications for deacons and elders. It's a beautiful manual. So that you may know how you ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, a pillar and a buttress of truth. That's really what's at stake here. The definition of the church, the pillar and the buttress of truth. The stakes are high, aren't they? The church is the pillar and buttress of truth. We had better get its function correct. Ephesians 4:11. So he wants order. He wants us to know how we ought to behave. He is the God of order. Then what has he given us to carry out this order? Ephesians 4:11. And he, just can you glance up above verse 11? And answer the question of who is the he? And he gave. Who is it? Christ. It is Christ. And he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and teachers to equip the saints for the work of the ministry, for building up the body of Christ. He gave. This is one of the blood-bought, spirit-leading gifts of Jesus Christ. Shepherds, pastors. Kevin DeYoung says, to reject this office in the church is to say that you don't want part of what Christ has won for us in his own resurrection. I think that Bible Truth Chapel and Eric Shelley has done a great job emphasizing that this gift is important in church life. To say that, because you see the context, can you glance at the context in chapter 4? What's happening? And he who ascended first descended. He set captives free, and at his resurrection, he won for the church gifts. And when the resurrected Savior, the head of the church, whose own blood has purchased us, comes to us and says, here is a gift, we don't turn up our nose. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 17. So, if God is a God of order, and if the Bible is meant to tell us how to behave, and if it's Christ himself who has won for us at the resurrection gifts for order, including pastors, shepherds, then what should we expect that function to be? Hebrews 13:17. Obey your leaders and submit to them, for they are, here's the gift, keeping watch over your souls as those who will give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with groaning, for that would be of no advantage to you. If this is the order and this is the gift, we should expect a blessing from the gift. God is the giver, not just of ambiguous gifts, but what kind of gifts? James 1. Good gifts. God is the giver of good gifts. We should expect the gift of bishop, of pastor, to be a good gift. And it is a gift for watching over our souls. That's good. The English term bishop, let's just review a little bit of the vernacular here. The English term bishop means overseer, sometimes used to translate from the Greek word episkopos, which means one who epi, over, skopos, sees. Episkopos, one who oversees. We consider the term bishop and overseer as equivalent to elder. The term elder, gets its root in Old Testament tribal history. Every group of people had over them a chief, an elder. This is where the New Testament term points our thinking back to that delegated care of small groups of people. An equality of responsibility and accountability, but delegated sections of responsibility. The term pastor, poimen, occurs only in the passage we just read. Poimen, pastor, as a title in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11. He gave some pastors. But the verb form of that word, poimenion, occurs all the time. To shepherd, to feed. Closely related to this term, pastor. I want to say a word here about shepherding. What are shepherds? What are shepherds? The very specific answer I'm looking for here would be difficult. Okay, an overseer? Guide? Care for the sheep? Good. A protector? Yes, thinking about the staff that a shepherd has. Pardon? To feed? The responsibility to feed? The shepherd is foremost a sheep. A shepherd is a sheep. So when we think of shepherd, we think of a lot of things, but maybe late in the thought process, we think he is a sheep. He is only an under-shepherd, but he is the sheep of the Most High Shepherd, right? So the greatest delight of the shepherd is to be a sheep. The greatest delight of the shepherd, the pastor, is that he is included as a sheep. So, here's what's important. When we think about plurality of eldership, we have to be careful that we don't think of some sort of democratic representation. Democratic representation. Would all of the young people in the room please raise your hand? Thank you, David. All of the smart people, all of the simple people, all of the elderly people, all of the wealthy people, all of the poor people, all of the ... We have to be careful that we don't conclude that eldership means let's get an elder that represents the elderly, let's get an elder that represents the young, let's get an elder that represents the outreach ministry, let's get an elder that represents the inward discipleship ministry. We have to be careful that we don't think of elders as people who represent certain demographics of our existence, but elders who represent a theocratic existence. So we don't want democratic representation, we want theocratic representation. Theos is God. Theocratic is that rule by God. So we want shepherds who see themselves first as under shepherds, who see themselves first as sheep. So the apostle could say, with everyone who's ever been willing to be an elder, follow me only as I follow Christ. So as I am a sheep to thee, good shepherd, then follow me like I was representing his shepherdship among the family of God. Okay? So, conversation, and then I have six steps. Conversation. Yes, please.
The point you just
We remind each other all the time.
And we as a body shouldn't forget that.
Yes.
That we somehow say, you are sheep that need to be fed.
So important. And I know that that some men had collectively read the title, The Dangerous Calling. And that's at the heart of The Dangerous Calling. To think that because you're responsible for caring for A Dangerous Calling by Paul Tripp is a fantastic book if you want a peek into the very real struggles in the pastorship that are a detriment to spiritual well-being, which was a hugely significant book in my life about 4 years ago. And that's really at the heart of it, when the shepherd forgets that he is a sheep, that there's all sorts of peril that comes then. Yeah, and likewise, when the congregation forgets that the shepherd is a sheep. Yeah, I think that we will interact with each other with much more patience and gentleness and kindness when we remember the collateral identification that we are all sheep. And if you think of sheep, you don't necessarily think of perfection. Okay? Okay, good, good. Any other addition to that?
Yes. As myself, a believer in Christ, she said, stop putting me on a pedestal because I'm a believer that goes overseas to minister to the people that need to know the Lord.
Yes.
And if we start looking at our body of believers the same way, what a difference we make in where we are, whether we're here in Wausau, if we're overseas, or if we're traveling.
And that was helpful. That was helpful for you to hear someone else who you admired say, we are both in process. We are humans becoming. Good. That's good. That's good. Okay. You know, one thing that we didn't do last week that just dawned on me as she was sharing that, she was sharing an experience. And I had asked you 2 weeks ago if anyone would be willing to give me the positive and negative experience that they had in a congregation that had plurality of eldership. So I'd like to take about 5 minutes. And if anyone has an experience, maybe you can point out the negative, and it will serve us as a warning and some conversation about what went wrong in that plurality of eldership. First of all, how many of you have ever been a part of a plurality of eldership? Okay, that's an inaccurate answer, because if you go to church at IBC, you have two elders. So you have plurality of eldership. But, of course, that's not exactly what the question I was asking, was it? So how many of you have been a part of a church that had a variety of lay eldership? How many of you? And so several of you raised your hand. Would anyone say you had a particularly fond experience there or a particularly alarming experience there? Would anyone say you had a... Yes, please.
Charles Ryrie started a church in Dallas. He was a teaching pastor, but saw himself as one of the elders and not over.
Right. He saw an equality.
And he said, I don't want to be in charge
of
this group of body.
Yeah. Yeah, I can testify to the fact, and maybe anyone else who has been has handled the mantle of being accountable to God for other people's soul, their well-being and their spiritual health. Early, I imagine that singular, you know, the buck stops here, and that quickly diminished into a sense of awe that I want plurality and accountability and partnership in this. Yeah. Okay, and that's Charles Ryrie. Okay, yes, please.
We were not members of the church, but my brother-in-law, who's a pastor of a church, started it 35 years ago, and it grew significantly. And his body of elders, this is going to be a negative.
Okay, it's fine. That's fine. There are some.
It's one of our concerns about the elders.
Sure. Well, that's always a good sign. Yeah. Yeah.
And chose to take the church in a different direction and said that my brother-in-law was done. So how do you prevent
Can you tell me just a brief summary of the directional difference? So what was the direction they wanted?
I would say they wanted more of a country club type church.
Yeah, really exclusive. Yeah. Yeah.
And my brother-in-law has very much of a passion for the lost.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. And then can you also please tell me how many elders did they have at the time? Do you know?
I think they had 12 at the time.
12? Okay. Did they have deacons?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I would say that admittedly, the only solution to that is to be led by the Spirit, consumed with the Word. That's the only solution to that. If people are not led by the Spirit, and it sounds like something really internal, something kind of selfish. It wasn't a doctrinal issue. It was a methodological issue, it sounds like. So you have the non-negotiable theological issues. That's the top of our pyramid. That's the tip of the spear. And then underneath that, you have your philosophy. Well, if this is what I believe about God, then this is what I think we should do. And then you have your methodology. This is how we'll carry it out. And it sounds like that conversation, that debate or division was happening way down here in methodological, which is tragic. And so spirit-led, consumed by the Word, is the solution. But whenever you have a small group of confidants or delegates who are responsible for something, the likelihood of persuasion increases. So in other words, a congregation of 400 is less likely persuaded by a small group of people than a board of 10, correct? Okay, so the strength in numbers theory. So that's a sad account, and I think one of the things that would have to be applied in retrospect. Now, is your brother still, or your brother-in-law, is he still pastoring anywhere?
Yes.
He is? Does he still have a church that has plurality of eldership?
Not in the same.
Not in that way.
Not
yeah.
That way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. That's good. Fool me once, right? I think the calling process is very important at that point. That pastors are being called. Not just popular people. It's possible that sometimes popular people are being affirmed as elders and then not able to carry out the pastorship with spiritual maturity. And then the other thing I would point out, because I'm advocating for that, is that for every account of an elder board steering, there are accounts of deacon boards steering. And so no matter what polity we choose, it's always going to have imperfections because it's being carried out by men. So that's a good example, though. It's a good example of where there was discord among the elders. I have a pastor friend in Iowa who has implemented a plurality of eldership, and he has what he calls his nuclear option. And the nuclear option is when the elders cannot be in unity and harmony, and at that point the whole thing blows up. So it's obliterated. There are no more elders. And then the congregation is responsible to say, okay, they could not come to unity on this issue. They are no more. The congregation's called on to start it over. And so he calls that a nuclear option. I have never been a part of a plurality of eldership that couldn't come to a unity on something. Now, there's been disagreement, but the conclusion was we won't move on that now, and then we would come back to it later. But I've never been to an irreconcilable difference with plurality of eldership. But that's heartbreaking to hear that there are people who do that. Pancho. He put that in place?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He saw men that weren't qualified, but those men didn't have terms. So, not terms, but a sabbatical. Like,
yes, yes.
There wasn't a break. It was a long time. And after several years, maybe 12 or something like that, the missionary felt called to go to a different place.
Oh.
I said, hey, I want the first mid-year.
Ah, yeah.
I should be in charge. Because of that, the other ones didn't. They saw more as an equal. They tried to walk with him, but at the end, the church was kind of split.
Yeah, yeah. So you're describing the problem that Paul wrote to the Corinthians. I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, I am of... And then Paul says, is Christ divided? What's going on? And so... yes?
While he was going, while they were united, while all of them were united, he was great. I mean, the church was growing.
Right. Right. Yeah, so two examples of individuals who have functioned selfishly. I think, as I heard you describe that, I think about Diotrephes. We talked about this. Peter? John? Okay, thank you. I said Peter the first time, too, didn't I? Diotrephes and John. John says, I want to come and minister to you, and I want to come and teach you. But Diotrephes, loving his own preeminence, has forbidden us to come. And Diotrephes is considered by most Bible students to be a deacon in the church and having selfish ambition instead of being selfless in the service of others. So two sad accounts that unfortunately are also accounted in Scripture. As long as the church has been the New Testament church, there have been accounts of people, deacons, members, elders, who have been kind of grabby. Chris?
So where would the office of member come in to impact these two situations where the elders were acting elders?
Well, as I accounted to this pastoral acquaintance in Iowa who has this nuclear option, when the nuclear option happens, when the button is pushed, and the elders cease to be, and the congregation then has to step in and say, okay, we had a problem there. We are now responsible for reaffirming or affirming different elders. And the other one, too, it's sad that the congregation allowed itself to be disjointed, kind of followed blindly. There seems like there was only elder rule. And as an elder went that way, then he took these people he'd influenced with him and then these people with him. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem like they practice that fortitude to say, yes, I have an affinity for you, but not more than I have for the whole church. So the congregation does seem to have stumbled in its congregational role. I don't know how the church survived after that, or I know how they did over 10 years, but I don't know how the congregation with those elders, was there a split then immediately? Yeah, unfortunately, we're hearing accounts of congregationalism that was really dissuaded instead of responsible. Yes?
Yeah, I'd like to share a positive experience.
Okay. A positive experience about a church?
I know.
You might be making this up,
right,
but we'll listen.
The church I had attended before moving back to Wausau was elder-led, and the congregation was very intentional to be praying for the elders.
Okay. Okay.
I think there were six elders.
Okay.
And then a lead teaching elder.
Okay.
They represented their pastor. But just a great opportunity.
Yeah.
Really two humble men who love the Lord. But I think that stems from the congregation's love and joy to pray for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Good. That was out in Washington?
No. Chicago.
Oh, that was the one in Chicago. Okay. Okay. Oh, that's right. Moody, Chicago. Yeah, okay. Yeah, not only a positive church experience, but Chicago? Yeah. All right. We're going to fact check that. We'll get back to you. Yes, please.
The nuclear option sounds really good theoretically.
Yeah, yeah.
If that eliminating the elders does not eliminate somebody from the church, then you've got to...
They're still in the church. You still have that persuasion in church life. Yes, please.
Church I was at before coming here, we had just deacons and then we had three pastors.
Okay.
And we also had trustees. Our deacons function like elders.
Okay.
The spiritual stuff and everything. So it's kind of like what you're describing as elders.
Mm-hmm.
And then the trustees, and I was on the trustee board, we took care of all that other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We're all there, but the title over the, yeah.
And what was good about it is the men in that church, I mean, one of the reasons why I moved up to Wisconsin to that church, the men were so good that when the first pastor when I was there retired, the church kept growing while they were looking for another guy. We had guys that were
there were guys there, yeah. Great.
So, you know, the things you're describing, they were doing, and that is really positive.
That's good. Yeah, that's a really good example. Yeah, really good illustration. Yeah, because if you didn't have trustees there, you would have a whole group of men that were qualified to help other people that would have not had a place. So if all you had was deacons functioning as elders, there would have been a whole group of men who are really great pictures of service who wouldn't have had a place to land, but then you had trustees, so they landed there. And if they had just redefined biblical terms over them, it would be there. As I hear you describe situations, I would only like to balance that reflection. I have not grown up in churches that had plurality of eldership. This is something that's become a conviction of mine in my own ministry. But it wasn't the way I grew up. We never had plurality of eldership. In fact, I would contend, while my dad was almost always my pastor, that he would not have welcomed this, but it was existent. He was in the dictatorship category. I mean, there was no one that could confront or keep accountable or rebuke the pastor. So that would have really been more in the dictatorship category in my experience as a young man growing up. But even though that was the atmosphere, I remember the night I was about 10 years old, and I don't know, maybe I told this story. Forgive me if I've already told it. I'm sure I told this here. When the deacon showed up at the house late at night after I had just gone to bed. Okay, we had just gone to bed. I was not asleep yet. And a group of deacons, not all of them, showed up at our house and informed my dad. There had been a church split before we got to that place in Coldwater, Michigan. There had been a church split, and the two churches... My dad came to the church. They'd gone through a church split. They had a big building. They had a Christian school. They said, we can't afford to pay you, but we do have a parsonage, and you can use the church van for your transportation, and we can't afford to pay you just because we have all this overhead, and we just had a split. We're running with half of our congregation. Okay. So he went, and after about a year and a half, the church had started to grow and was doing really well, and those people that had left started to aspire to be back together. They wanted to be back together, which is great. So the deacons from both churches started to meet together, unbeknownst to my dad, started to meet together and discuss the terms of coming back. And the terms were, we'll keep your name, your building, but we're bringing our pastor. And so the deacons decided that was what was going to happen. They showed up at our house at probably 9:30 on a weeknight and said, this has been decided. You have 2 weeks. And let him know that. We didn't have plurality of eldership, but we still had... essentially that. The other one, he was pastoring in Holbrook, Michigan, which is up in the thumb. So if you're from Michigan and people want to know where you live, you go like this. Okay. So it was up in the thumb, and we had done some outreach endeavors to bring people from the community into church, and a group of deacons came to him after a particular Sunday morning and said, we want you to stop this. And he said, stop what? Stop reaching out to people that aren't from our church. We're happy with the church we have. Please don't include other people in it. That, of course, was the deal breaker. So there was not elders there either. So what you're describing is very natural, is tragically natural in church life that's being carried out by people who are not yet what we should be. Yes, please.
The church I grew up in had 12 pastors.
pastor, they had money in a building fund, and the pastor decided to take that money and do something else with it.
Uh-oh.
Which was not in accordance to what the deacon wanted to do.
Uh-oh.
And
nuclear option. Yeah.
And, of course, he had brought new people in, and the new people that had come in were all for whatever he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the Lord punished him because a few months later he was involved in a car accident where his son rear-ended him,
oh.
And he died.
Oh, my.
And I don't think that church is in existence anymore.
No?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was a situation, deacon-pastor conflict, I think is what I heard you say?
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. Okay.
Promotion?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe God was favoring him. Okay. Okay. Yes, please.
I came from a variety of churches that had this elder situation, but mainly in mainline denominations. I think with an independent church like we have, it would probably function a lot better. But back at all the mainline denominations, all had good doctrinal positions when they started. But they formed this Presbyterian type of government.
Mm-hmm.
They had elders, and they had pastors, and they also had leaders within these denominations. They made all the decisions concerning doctrinal positions that the church was supposed
to. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so you're describing some eldership without any congregational accountability or responsibility. So the congregation did not determine issues of doctrine, is what you're saying.
Well, the elders were elected by the congregation,
mm-hmm.
but still they were swayed by the pastors and the leadership within the church.
Right.
Came from liberal tendencies.
Mm-hmm. What are the main line? Can you give us specific? What are you?
Well, when I was saved, I was in United Church of Christ.
Oh, sure. I hear you. Okay, I hear you.
Then we went to the Reformed Church.
I hear you again.
then it starts. It has tendency to go to. Matter of fact, we talked with one of the members from the Reformed Church that we came from. They are now in the process. Trying to get out of the denomination.
Mm-hmm.
A number of them have done.
I know about that. Yep. Yes. Yes, and so that's why I appreciate you pointed those out, because you're making a distinction between independent churches and those churches that seem to almost be at the mercy of some sort of governance that's even apart from their weekly assembly. You know, the Reformed, there you have a local body, the Reformed Church, that's saying, what the national group is doing, we're not in favor of, and we're trying to get out of it. Kevin DeYoung, who I quoted before, he got out of the RCC, RCA, Reformed Churches of America. He recently left that and lost the whole church. So the church left, and the church had to stay. Because the RCA, I think is it PCA? RCC, right, Reformed? Anyway, the Reformed Church, they left it. Over probably the same issue that the church here in Wausau is, and they lost their church. They lost everything. The pianos had to stay. The chairs had to stay. Everything had to stay.
Well,
and the church,
the church
stayed.
People.
The church left. All right? Is that good? Is that good? Okay. So, yeah, I know exactly. Yeah, here's all the people. Steeple. Yeah, I grew up in church. Yeah. okay, go ahead. Well, Alexander Schrau uses a term which is somewhat of an oxymoron, but it helps explain the answer to your question. He uses the expression first among equals. So there is a unique position among the paid pastors in eldership only, I believe, because of what's afforded them in the day-to-day intimate operation of church life. There becomes an advantage for that man. But there would be an equality of accountability. So if, if one of the elders said to a paid elder, you know, we've noticed this in your life, in your conduct, in your interaction with people, and we're going to hold you accountable for this to make improvement in the Lord, there would then be an equality. But functionally, I think there's going to be, just because of the day-to-day operation of church life, you're meeting with people, you're counseling, you're discussing administrative things much, much more thoroughly than those bivocational elders would be. Yes, always together, always together. And my recommendation for this season is that we have the chairman of our deacons meet with the elders when they meet, and vice versa, that we have an elder meet with the deacons when they meet, so that we have representation, so that there's good communication, there's good, what's that called, synergy. There's good synergy between the groups, not, you know, deacons are pulling the plow this way and elders are pulling the plow this way, and they seem to be conflicting. It's good to have someone represented in both, so they can talk about mutual vision and facilitation of vision in church life. Let me go through these seven. I've got about 10 minutes left, and you've given us great dialogue. Let me just go through these seven. Here it is. Okay, here are the steps that I am recommending and asking you to consider forward. Step one, teach. Okay, that has been the last 3 months. We have walked through consideration of is this descriptive? Is this prescriptive? Does the Bible call us to consider the order versus the chaos? Has God gifted us with the gifts for order? And what do those gifts look like? Okay. Then two, an affirmation of the process. What do I want to use here? Okay, I talked about this last week. To affirm or to vet men by our presently seated search committee that will be made as a recommendation to the congregation. Okay, an affirmation of those men as a recommendation to the congregation. Now, the reason that I think it's important to use this step, which will not be a long-term step. Long-term, the steps will be elders will recommend to the congregation elders. But right now, there are only two of us. And so we think it's prudent to use the multiple counsel of the seated search committee, which has been entrusted by the congregation to find the next paid pastor. I think it's reasonable that we can trust them to find the next non-paid pastor. Or at least make the recommendation to the congregation, I should say. All right. So this is already happening. It's not done yet because they haven't met, so maybe I shouldn't put a check there. It'll be half a check. Okay. Is that too much? Doesn't really represent where we are in the process. Okay, so what's happened is we have solicited and asked the search committee to give us names. So when I came, not knowing people as well as the rest of you know people, knowing from it's been about 4 years that the deacons and church members have been discussing the need for plurality of eldership, and I think it goes back to maybe Dick Crump and Poncho and Ben carried that through, and then. Larry came and he emphasized that, and then even Scott Menez, who came and he talked about this is where I would go, and then I came and I said this is where I would go, and so it's not surprised. If you're surprised, raise your hand, and we'll have your hearing checked. Okay, so it's not a surprise. This is where we are, but this has been happening because when I came, for me to go out and say, okay, you and you and you seem like great guys, let me lay a hand of blessing on you would be to lay hands on someone prematurely, right? So we're warned about this regarding offices. And so what I did is I went to Mike. I said, Mike, what names would you give for the men that should be watched for future eldership. And then Dan was still here. Dan, what names would you give? And then I talked to Gary. I talked to Bob Ross. I talked to Chris Menard. I talked to probably two or three other people. And then went to the search committee and said, would you please give me names of people who you have observed over the years, faithful, shepherd, giftedness? Yes, yes, so they did. I have all those. What is a blessing to me is how much duplicity I'm seeing in all the recommendations, okay? So I can tell you, in all the recommendations, I probably have something like six names, and three of them keep coming up, keep coming up, keep coming up, okay? So this is happening. But there will be a time, I asked you last week, and I think that I agree with what you were saying, that we should, before actually affirming an individual for eldership, we should ask the congregation to consider an amendment to our Constitution, which would say something like, this is only an example, simply state that not all of the church's elders are vocational in nature, and that whenever the Lord should raise up another qualified and willing elder, they would be commended to the church by the existing elders for congregational affirmation. It would say something like that. It would be a parenthetical statement under the category of pastor. It would say something like, they don't all get paid, but we might have some among us who can be recommended to the congregation by the elders, and the congregation would affirm them. Okay? And that, I think, is something we should do earlier rather than later. Okay? Fourth. The congregation is informed. So the congregation is then made aware, these are the names of men who have been recommended and affirmed by the elders that are and are being given to the congregation. So then the congregation will get those names. Something like a month before they're actually asked to vote on them. That month would be prayer. It would be asking them to go to dinner after church. It would be asking that elder and his wife to come to your house and visit with you. Okay? But there will be a month of information before there's any action. Fifth. Congregational affirmation. This will be the point where the congregation will be given a piece of paper with a person's name, and you'll be asked to say, I agree or I don't agree. If you don't agree, we need to know why you don't agree. Okay? We need to know why you don't agree. Because we need to know if you're saying never for this person, or if you're saying, hey, maybe not yet. We need to know that. Because if every year we bring that same name to you and you keep saying no, why is this happening? All the time we're going through all this process of bringing the same name and they keep saying no. Okay. Then, sixth. Four-year service. One-year sabbatical. Okay? All right, so those are six steps. We have about 3 minutes, and we have next Sunday. In these 3 minutes now, do you have any questions? Does this seem clear? Can you see it, Dave? Kind of, just a reflection.
So how many elders can there be?
Yes, great question. 15, there could be. I don't know how many God's going to bring us. So if God raises up here eventually 12 men, that would be a blessing. I anticipate that Emmanuel is going to reach much, much larger percentages of our community in the future. And if the church has 1,000 people, I hope it has 12, 15, 20 elders. If the church has 400 people, I would hope that it has 4, 5, 6. So I don't know how many God's going to bring us. But he'll bring us enough for the need. He has gifted the church with everything it needs.
I come from a world of job descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to have a specific job description of what they are and what they're not?
Yes, yes, I would. But there would not be a distinction in job description between my own and theirs. So as far as the Bible lays out the description of pastoral responsibility, feeding, leading, nurturing, protecting, those would be the descriptions. So the New Testament description would be the description for these men. The reason for that is because I don't want to create an unbiblical super deacon elder hybrid model. And so I want to keep similarity with eldership. So whether it's Mike or myself, or whether it's a lay elder, I want it to be similar in what's required by the congregation of those men. Yes, Kurt. I don't think there was one when I came, which was startling. I was surprised. This is what happens. Well, that's obvious. Look what I can do. Yeah, right? A husband-wife couple?
Right.
So can a wife serve? Yes, I would say yes. I would say yes. We presently don't have, to my knowledge, any distinction of, you know, if you're serving this, your spouse can't serve that. So yes. So Kurt, that was a little bit surprising to me, because usually when you're calling a vocational pastor, especially to a church like Emmanuel, there usually is something pretty, it's becoming more and more all the time a master's requirement. And that wasn't, there might have been a bachelor's requirement. Yeah. Right, right. Yes, I'm sure it showed up on resumes. So I have a master's, and maybe that was considered outside of what was listed as requirements. I'm thankful it wasn't a requirement. For instance, my brother, I told you my brother's going over to candidate at this church. It's got like 20 people and can't afford to pay anybody. And, I mean, it's on life support. And they mentioned to him that they would really like someone with a master's. Sure, why not go for a doctorate? I mean, you deserve it. So sometimes churches do that, and because it's kind of like this, you know, hey, our church has a pastor better than your pastor down the road. So I'm thankful it wasn't there, but I'm pretty confident it was taken into consideration. I don't know what Mike's, I think Mike has pretty extensive degrees in music. Yes, please. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's such a practical question and point, I think an important point. I was thinking just a few weeks ago about how important it will be for us to facilitate those men for teaching. And so that may include taking some courses. I know one of the things that's really nice is that you can audit classes for almost no money. You still get all the information, but at the end you don't get the certificate. The other thing is there are so many great resources that I think our church should make available. I mentioned this when I was here candidating. I think our church should make available to our pastors in general, paid or not paid. There's a software that I use called Logos Software, which is phenomenal. I don't know how a pastor goes through without things like that. Yes, please. We'll finish with this one, so make it good.
Yeah. How do you view ordination?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so great question. How do you view ordination? I'm not ordained. Bum, bum, bum. Yeah, I'm not. When I went to Greenwood, when I was at Jefferson, they did a licensing there, and so I had a group of men sign a licensure of ministry. But I didn't get ordained. That was one thing that they asked about on the search committee. They said, what about ordination? Let me give you my cynical answer. You ordained? I knew there was something wrong with you. So ordination. Here's what ordination is. Ordination is seven guys that you've never known signing a piece of paper that says, I know what they think I know. And then I hand you the piece of paper and say, here, these seven guys said I knew what I know. Good. Now we're confident. So ordination, in my opinion, is really, really less significant than congregational affirmation. So you should take much more significantly the fact that the congregation in Greenwood said, yes, for 10 years, this man was faithfully our pastor, than you should a piece of paper that says seven men who are from Michigan said that I believed what I believe. So that's where I'm at ordination. But it would be fun. I think so. Because then you have the local congregation affirming. Yes. Okay, I'm over time. Go quick.